Hi, welcome to James Miller Lifeology, where you learn to simplify and transform your spirit, mind, and body. My name is James Miller. I'm a licensed psychotherapist and a composer. Thank you so much for joining me today in this podcast. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get your free audiobook and a free 30-day trial at www.audibletrial.com/James Miller Lifeology. I have a great show for you today. I'll be reminding you how you are the one who determines your success. I'll also be interviewing Dr. Margaret Tolbert, who is an author and a biochemist who shares her personal story of overcoming adversity and defining her own success. You all know me as a psychotherapist, but many of you do not know me as a composer. My latest album, Restoration, was just released. Restoration is a continuation of the first album, Consolation. I like to think of these albums like books. Each original composition is written like a chapter in a book. And like in any story, the character goes from a sense of grief and loss, and at the end of Consolation, finds hope for his future. In Restoration, he has an awakening. And in that awakening, he recognizes all the things in his life which are not healthy, and it helps him come to a place of restoration, becoming greater than he was before. You may purchase this album on iTunes or any other digital music store. The name of the album is Restoration, and my stage name is James S. Miller. The name of the piece you are currently hearing is entitled Introspection. There once was a young man who was a son of a traveling horse trainer who would go from stable to stable, racetrack to racetrack, farm to farm, and ranch to ranch, training horses. As a result, the boy's high school career was continually interrupted. When he was a senior, he was asked to write a paper about what he wanted to be and do when he grew up. That night, he wrote a 7-page paper describing his goal of someday owning a horse ranch. He wrote about his dream in great detail and even drew a diagram of a 200-acre ranch, showing the location of all the buildings, the stables, and the track. Then he drew a detailed floor plan for a 4,000-square-foot house that would sit on his dream ranch. He put a great deal of his heart into this project, and the next day he handed it in to his teacher. 2 days later, he received his paper back. On the first page was a large red F with a note that read, "See me after class." The boy with the dream went to see the teacher after class and asked, "Why did I receive an F?" The teacher said, "This is an unrealistic dream for a young boy like you. You have no money, you come from an unstable family, you have no resources, and owning a horse ranch requires a lot of money. You have to buy the land, you have to pay for the original breeding stock, and later you'll have to pay large stud fees. There's no way you could ever do it." Then the teacher added, "If you rewrite this paper with more realistic goals, I might consider your grade." The boy went home and thought about it long and hard. He asked his father what he should do. His father said, "Son, you have to make up your own mind on this. However, I think it is a very important decision for you." Finally, sitting with it for a week, the boy turned in the same paper, making no changes at all. He stated, "You can keep the F, and I will keep my dream." Today, Monty Roberts, the famous horse trainer, now owns a 4,000-square-foot home in the middle of a 200-acre horse ranch, just like he dreamed as a boy. He also has hanging over his fireplace his failed school assignment. You determine your success. All throughout history, we hear biographies of people who are very successful. We look at their lives and think, man, if I only had that opportunity, or if I only was talented the way they are. But we often forget that sometimes the way they were raised or the environment in which they were brought up is not equal to how they were later on in life. What separates those people who are very successful in life, regardless of how they're brought up, versus the people who society may not think is successful? One of the main components of that is your self-perception. Regardless of what your circumstances are when you grow up, does not determine how successful or how you're going to end. I've worked with many people throughout the years, and many of them struggle with their identity today because of what happened to them yesterday or what happened to them years ago. One thing that's really important to remember is whatever the situation is that happened does not mean that's who you are. When you identify yourself as that event, for example, you're a widowed person or you're a divorced person or you're someone who went through bankruptcy or you're a sick person, that identity then limits you from becoming the person that you can become. It's so important to find those traits within yourself that you're proud of, that you can really nourish, that you can hone those skills to become a different person. You think of a fish. If a fish is supposed to be 2 feet long, but put in a small aquarium, it will never reach its highest potential because its environment limits it. That's the same type of thing in our mind. When we limit ourselves to what our environment says we can do, or reaching that glass ceiling that our environment says that's as far as we can go, then all of a sudden that's the truth. That's as far as we're going to go. Perhaps in the Western culture, there seems to be a lot of limitations when it comes to someone's age or their gender or their race or their socioeconomic background. Sometimes society says that those factors will determine how far you can go in life. But you look at different cultures, and some cultures are very matriarchal. They can have women prime ministers, and women can do many different things, or age is looked at as a factor that's of wisdom and really nurtured and appreciated. That's something to really think about. Just because your culture today may say something about a deficit that you feel you have does not mean that that's how the world views it. And when you can potentially look at something from a different frame of mind, whatever your culture limits you as having does not mean it's a limitation at all. It's just simply something that's ingrained in you. And that's not the truth at all. I would ask you to look at some of those thoughts that you have. If you're wanting to try something new, wanting to try something different, what are the immediate thoughts that you have which say you can't do it? If those thoughts are telling you that you don't have the ability to do it, well, once again, those are just thoughts. Remember, a thought is just a thought. It doesn't mean it's true. One of the things in psychology that we have are what's called thinking errors. So whatever we perceive to be true determines what we feel. What we feel determines what's going to happen. And so the thinking errors are essentially the lens that we put over that perception, which skews how we perceive the world. And one of those thinking errors is emotional reasoning. Emotional reasoning is essentially what I feel must be true. And that's not the case at all, because if we live in that feeling, for example, if I feel I'm stupid today, well, then that means I am stupid. And that's not true. So when we have those thoughts that we feel are true, we really have to look at our logic to say, wait a minute, what is the tangible evidence which proves that I'm this way or which disproves it? And if you recognize it's just a thought, well, it's just a thought. So I would really challenge you today to ask yourself, why is my environment or why is my current situation limiting me from becoming that person that I want to become? We all have those dreams within us. We all have those goals within us. And for some reason, we don't move on to the next level or move on to the next step to fulfill them because our current situation or perhaps what we were told as a child stops us from taking those next steps. But remember, your future is only as successful as you want it to be. What you think about yourself and how you've identified yourself will determine how far you go in life. You have a beautiful, wonderful life. You're more talented than what you think, and your potential is limitless. So remember, how you started in life does not determine how successful you're going to be today. And now, a quick word from my sponsor. Audible.com is offering you, my listener, a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/JamesMillerLifeology. Many of you don't know this about me, but I'm an avid reader, so this is a no-brainer for me to go ahead and download any audiobook I'd like to read, specifically if I'm walking my dog, at the gym, or just even driving. So for you to get your free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/JamesMillerLifeology. They have over 180,000 books for you to choose from, so I'm pretty confident you'll find the one you're looking for. So check it out today.
I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Margaret Ellen Mayo Tolbert, who is the author of Resilience in the Face of Adversity. She is a retired scientist and a former senior advisor at the National Science Foundation. Dr. Tolbert holds a doctorate in biochemistry from Brown University, a master of science in analytical chemistry from Wayne State University, and a bachelor of science in chemistry from Tuskegee University. She has a very inspiring show for us today. Welcome to my show, Dr. Tolbert.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful. I'm sure when people hear all your credentials and all the academia that you've had in your life, I'm sure they're probably surprised when they hear how you grew up.
I was born in Suffolk, Virginia, not too far from here, maybe three and a half hours drive from here, in a section, Saratoga. It was the section for colored people. And we did have a good mix of different people of different origins who were colored. For instance, of African descent, of Japanese descent, of other ethnicities. And my early childhood included stay with my mother and father, that's Clifford and Martha Mayo. And then my mother moved away with us to another section of town, which was for colored people, called South Suffolk. And while there, she died.
Oh, gosh.
And during that time, for our survival, the neighbors took us in. We were six kids.
And oh, my gosh.
And the family took us in. So we moved from home to home. And then eventually my grandmother came to get us and brought us back into the Saratoga section where she lived. And so most of my early years after the death of my mother, those years were spent with grandmother Fanny, or we call her Grandma Fanny. And once I finished my elementary education, East Suffolk High School, which was about a two-mile walk from where I lived in Saratoga. And it was quite an adventure. I enjoyed my time at East Suffolk and at Ida B. Easter Graded School. At first, the change in going from one neighborhood to the other was difficult. But I adjusted. Everybody was friendly. There were different aspects of the high school that I really enjoyed. For instance, can you believe it? I was in the modern dance group. I was on the yearbook staff, and I did a number of things to keep busy, as if I didn't have enough to do with the two-mile walk back and forth, one way there, 2 miles, one way back, 2 miles.
Wow.
And both schools were segregated, as was the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, on the 11th, I gave a presentation in my hometown of Suffolk as a result of an invitation from the Daughters of Suffolk. And it was at the Suffolk Historical Society. And I told them about how it was in Suffolk.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, it wasn't just the segregation of the neighborhoods. It was segregated all over. For instance, in the downtown theater, which my sister's brother and I attended periodically, it was segregated. Colored people sat in the balcony, white people on the main floor.
That's so crazy.
And can you imagine that? And
my gosh.
Where there were water fountains, they were labeled colored white. And let me go back to the neighborhood to give you an idea of what the streets were. Not paved, they were gravel. There were open ditches for waste, and there were outside toilets. We didn't get electricity until in the early 50s. It was, I said, this is the stuff for a movie.
We
had small businessmen, like African. Notice I said colored first. So we've changed our race name several times. So colored African-American now, Afro-American prior to that, and then we were Negroes, and then Black, and other colored, and go on and on like that. But that's good. We're progressing. We're trying to better get a racial title that better fits.
But you know what's kind of what's interesting to me, and let me stop here for 1 second, is I have the privilege of knowing where Suffolk is because I actually did my graduate work in Virginia Beach, and I had a lot of friends who were in Suffolk, and so I know the high school, I know all those areas. I'm obviously not as well as you, but I do know that area. So when you're saying those things, I can think of the theater, I can think of the high school, I know where that is. So for me, this is kind of a treat because I've seen it, you know, years later, but I have a rough idea of some of the landmarks to which you're referring.
Right. The tenure that I'm talking about is 1943 to 1963. So in 1963, I went away to college. That was to Tuskegee University. And the interesting thing is being poor, and my father died when he was about 40. My mother was about 30. The people in the neighborhood, we hear the saying, child raised by the community. I think I fit in that category the best because people looked out for me and my siblings very much so. And there was a family there in Suffolk. They didn't live in Saratoga. They were middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say middle class. And they took me under their wings and supported me fully. And they also drove in their car. Took me to Tuskegee. Imagine that in the 50s.
Yes.
It was very dangerous, but we were lucky nothing happened negative.
Yes.
So I've enjoyed my life. It's gotten better and better as I aged. And now I'm retired.
Which is wonderful. Well, let me ask you this, because when you were going to Tuskegee, weren't you also, what was your job? Let me just ask you that. What was your employment during the time while you were going to university?
When I was at Tuskegee, I had a partial fellowship, and there were a lot of small pieces that were put together in terms of dollars and the like, put together to help me pay for expenses. I had applied to three universities and accepted all three, and the other two, which I will not name, did give me full scholarship. But
wow.
The people that I knew said that I would be very comfortable at Tuskegee because there were people there that they knew, and mm-hmm. they had participated in programs there or had taken courses there. Interestingly, once I got there, I was introduced to a family that worked on the campus. The husband and wife worked on the campus. So mm-hmm. then they took me under their wing.
Oh, wow. So you have all these people who watch over you. That's wonderful. Now, how was your self-esteem? How was your self-esteem? So as you are, the whole segregation component, unfortunately, your parents passed away. You were moved to these different homes. How was your self-esteem during that time?
I was too young during the period mm-hmm. to feel deeply, I should say, how negative the situation was that I was in.
Okay.
I had my siblings with me, and we made it together as long as we were together, and that was our mm-hmm. mother's wish that we stay together. And I think that was an excellent decision that she made before her death, that we kept together. And that grouping helped me, but also the people around me were not negative toward us. The students were not negative. And I think it may have been because a lot of them were in the same situation I was in. They were rich. Like, and you asked me about what I did at Tuskegee for work. I did do a short period. I did do what they call work study, where I had a job on campus. But it wasn't anything that took away from my studies, because in chemistry, a lot of time had to be spent studying and working in the laboratory.
Yes.
You know, doing your laboratory coursework. So there wasn't much time to do anything else.
Okay. For some reason, I thought you were a maid for a certain period, but I must have read that wrong at one time.
Oh, that didn't happen while I was at school. That happened while I was in high school in the summertime. A few other young people and I went up to Cuttybackville, New York, to White House Lodge, which was owned and operated by an African-American lady. And she invited a number of young people to come in to do maid service and the like. So I was cleaning rooms. And I was cleaning 15 rooms per day, and I was called in by the owner, and I thought, I've done something wrong. But no, she complimented me on my work and promoted me to being in charge of the maid service.
Oh, wow.
Now, but it meant that I would clean 29 rooms a day.
Oh.
and help the others when they had, the questions of enough sheets and the like. And so I thought, but I thought nothing negative about it. I just like keeping busy.
Certainly.
And then the maid service while I was in grade school, that was where Mr. and Mrs. S.A. Cook took me under their wings. This is the couple that drove me to see. Mrs. Cook, I met her because she was a Girl Scout troop, scoutmaster in Saratoga. After school, that was one of the after-school activities where my friends belonged to it. And I found out that at those meetings, they serve cookies and milk, and I have a sweet tooth. So I would go to the meetings, and eventually Mrs. Cook, the scout leader, pulled me to the side, and she told me that I couldn't continue to attend the meetings because I wasn't a member. And so I asked, well, what do I have to do to be a member? Because I figured I'd been to the meetings with my friends, and we'd had a good time. So she said, no, you have to pay a fee and do this and that. And, I knew I didn't have the money. So even though I was, I would scrub floors for 50 cents. And at that time, those people who were well off enough had hardwood floors. And that was the time when you used paste wax and you hit it down and rub it and make it shine, buff it shine, to shine. And I would get paid for that. But it wasn't enough to join the Girl Scout troop. So once I told her about, my situation, and I'm sure it wasn't a good description at that time, because I was at that time I was in elementary school, she and her husband decided that they would help me out by adopting me.
Oh.
So I knew that she had to talk to my grandmother, Grandma Fanny. one day after the scout meeting, she went by. My grandmother was sitting on the front porch, and she approached and she talked with my grandmother. And my grandmother was not pleased at the suggestion that she invite, she adopt me, that she and her husband adopt me. So the answer was no.
Hmm.
Even though that was not so good for Mrs. Cook, she did ask if I could come over her house on weekends and help her with her work to help earn some money. And my grandmother said, sure, I could. So I did. So that's where the maid service.
Okay, I'm thinking of that book, The Help, which that's my only, you know, from the movie. I think of some of the things that you say, and you know, in that, and I can kind of see you in that. So okay, wow, that's a great. I love to see the juxtaposition or the comparison between where someone was versus where they are now, and it all makes up who we are. And we can't piecemeal it, but the beauty of who we are is when every single situation that happens in our life.
Yes, and in writing Resilience in the Face of Adversity, which is available online, it's not in bookstores, it is online at all of the book sale sites, Resilience in the Face of Adversity. And you might say, well, what about the adverse circumstances? Well, think about it. As you read the book, you'll see that I survived in a dysfunctional family.
Mm-hmm.
I addressed issues and responsibilities that were not intended for a young person my age. Before I was in my late teens, I was essentially put in charge of my two younger sisters and brother because my grandmother got sick and her dad came in to live with her. And we thought that my siblings and I and our cousins, thought that she would be coming back, but she didn't. She died.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, as we visited her, our cousins would drive us over to Portsmouth to visit her on her sickbed. And she did say in one instance, tell me that I was the strongest of the children.
The sibling group, sure.
And that I should take care of them. And so I did the best I could, but I wasn't going to let it stop me from things that I wanted to do. So one day, when it was clear she wasn't coming back, we just walked over, put our things in a little red wagon that my brother had, and we walked across town, which was farther than walking to my high school. And we walked across town and just moved in with my sister, her husband, and son. They had a house big enough for us without thinking. At that time, too, you know, telephones weren't as popular. Cell phones were not in use.
Of course.
In vogue, I should say. And so when you went to a person's house, they accepted you, the open arms. So we lived there until I graduated from high school and went on to college. But at one point, my sister, oldest sister, was listed as my guardian. And, you know, those were the days when university sent your grades to your parents.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
And they had to sign off on it and send the signed copy back to the university. And my sister was not literate. So a lot of things she would miss. And so I eventually changed my guardian to Mr. and Mrs. Cook. And they, in the later years of my tenure as a student at Tuskegee, they were the persons who took care of all that paperwork.
So it all worked out that you were able to work with them.
Yes. So at an early age, I was employed. I talked to you about that.
Mm-hmm.
I interacted with families that helped me out and people individually. A lot of times they were elderly people who just would look while I walked from one place to the other. They would be sitting on their porches and watching. And this was very good because this was like having a security group.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And, like the people's watch, of course.
Right. And so all went well. But I want to tell the audience, too, that as they read the book, of course, it will come on as entertainment. And some might say, well, this couldn't have happened in those times. But I'll tell you that everything that's in this book is true.
Mm.
What they should do is read, understand things like, what would I say to a student? I would say, never forget who you are and where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have done a number of things and been to several countries, to not as a tourist, but as a person completing a project, interacting in meetings and the like. Even though I've done all those things, unlike some people I've seen that when they reach certain heights, oh, you can't even talk to them.
They're untouchable now. Yes.
Right. I'm not like that. I appreciate it. So give you an idea of the foreign countries. I've done projects in Libya, Liberia, Kenya, Senegal, South Africa, Ghana, and the Sudan.
Oh, my gosh.
And the United States, I would say scattered throughout the United States, I've had projects. And these were done as a part of positions I held at different agencies and companies. In Europe.
You're also the first African-American and the first woman in charge of the Department of Energy lab?
Yes, that was the New Brunswick Laboratory. It's nuclear analytical chemistry, and it safeguards. It led the teams that went over to Russia to monitor the blend down of uranium. And, you know, they blend it down and send it back to the country of origin. But they have to blend it down first, and you have to make sure that people don't take some of it. So, and also that they follow the right procedure. So members of my staff were sent over there. I did not go to Russia because I was needed here in the United States to do different things. But I did go to the International Atomic Energy Agency several times, that's in Austria, to participate in meetings, to hold dialogue directly with officials there, to explain what we were doing at the New Brunswick Laboratory. And that laboratory is a network laboratory of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Wow.
So it was intense. It was, you know, I had to have a Q clearance, which means that the FBI was following me, you know, watching what I did. You know?
Wow. Do you ever think about that, that a young girl from Suffolk, Virginia, and here you are, all these countries, being part of these conferences and helping to make policies, do you ever reflect on that?
I do indeed, and I really appreciate having had the opportunity. There were even people there at the Department of Energy that really supported me, were encouraging to me, and I think they were amazed that here's an African-American who's doing all of this, and she's willing to travel here and there, and it was a part of my curiosity, too, but I like people. And I've been described as being severely extroverted. So when I go,
it's a perfect situation, yeah.
Yes, I don't go as a stranger. I'm going to find someone to whom to talk. So I say in what I've done, you develop a support base for yourself. But in the meantime, help someone else along. So I served as mentor for a number of students along the way. Some of them earn their doctorate degree, and they still make contact with me. And there were a few that I really have been in contact with, and they developed their plan, and they discussed their plans with me, and I gave input. But I always said to them, whatever I tell you is just advice. I'm not giving you orders. You do that. So they have to decide what they want to do. And out of all of the advice that they're being given, then prepare their program and move ahead in it. And if they decide on something that does not work for them, change it. But when you change something, make sure your decision is an informed decision.
Exactly.
Researched what you're going to do. Also, I always tell them, I'm not the only person who should serve as your mentor. Have others. Some people think, well, this is my mentor, and that's one person. No, you can have a variety of them because your being has
very complex aspects. Person.
Right. So you can talk to people in different areas. But I say, when you seek advice from people who have succeeded beyond where you are. Because your chances of being led in the wrong direction by somebody who's not as advanced as you are greater. So keep that in mind. And I said, for people who are sitting there and say, well, I have to keep my baby and take care of him. Well, I have a son. I was divorced when he was young. I kept on moving. So I said, don't just sit there and stare life in the face. Get out there and do something. You see?
That's great. I love that advice.
Yes. And so have a plan, though. Implement your plan. And like I said, as time goes on, if the plan isn't working out, change it, but do it in an informed way.
That is excellent.
You have to realize that you, as an individual, have a contribution to make in life. So do it, and don't let anybody stop you. And even as I'm retired, I'm still working, and I'm working now just as hard. I just don't have to report in ride down that expressway.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Dr. Tolbert, I want to thank you so much for being on my show. If my listeners would like to find out more information about you, is there a specific website where they may locate you?
Yes, I have a blog site, a Facebook site, and a Twitter site. Now, my blog site and Margaret Tolbert, all together, margaretolbert.wordpress.com. That's the blog site.
Okay.
Or the Facebook site is facebook.com/, and without periods or spaces in between, write my name, Margaret, M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T-E-M Tolbert. And the Twitter site is twitter.com/dr_Tolbert. My book is titled Resilience in the Face of Adversity. The subtitle is A Suffolkian's Life Story. And this book is available in three formats. It's an e-book format, soft cover, and hard cover. And so you can purchase them in either of those formats. And you look for them on any of the websites that sell books. For example, BalboaPress.com, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Borders and the like.
Excellent. Well, once again, Dr. Tolbert, thank you so much for being on my show. It was such a pleasure to get to know you.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I thank you for inviting me to be a part of this.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you, the listener, for joining with me today. Please subscribe to this podcast through whichever podcast portal you joined with me. If you're using iTunes and you like what you hear, please rate this podcast as well as leave your comments on the iTunes podcast page. Also, please visit my website where you may see all my YouTube episodes and published articles I've written for you. You may also enroll in the Lifeology Academy I created where you can take self-directed courses which are designed for successful people just like you. You may find all this information at jamesmillerlifeology.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening to this podcast episode today. Have a fantastic week, and I look forward to talking to you very soon.